rape of Brent Jeffs, and racketeering violations under the Utah version of the federal RICO statutes, spelled out in the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act of 1970. The feds had created this tool to fight the mafia. Now it could be used in the lawsuits against the FLDS, which I considered to be a criminal organization. For many of the lost boys, the only beacon of help was the Diversity Foundation and an extraordinarily kind man by the name of Dan Fisher, a brother of my new client, Shim Fisher. Dan had once been a polygamist with three wives, but he had abandoned the practice and left the FLDS fold more than a decade before we met. He now had only one wife, but as honor dictated, he continued to help support the other two. During that decade, Fisher had become financially successful by inventing and patenting teeth whitening systems, and he had created a nonprofit organization known as Smiles for Diversity. The organization recruited dentists and orthopedic surgeons to fix the teeth of children in third world countries. Because of Dan's reputation for helping people, desperate lost boys began finding their way to his doorstep. With Dan, they didn't have to explain. He understood what they had been through and wanted to help. At first, he fed and clothed the shattered youngsters and gave them a safe place to sleep. And when all of the bedrooms of his home were filled, he converted a big maintenance garage into apartments for extra capacity. He helped them gain a sorely needed education and life skills so that they could begin to understand the outside world, become independent, and move on. When the constant exodus of boys being exiled from their FLDS homes eventually got too big for Fisher to rescue them all on his own, he turned Smiles for Diversity into the more wide-ranging Diversity Foundation. An untold number of lives, hundreds, and perhaps thousands, have been put back together through the food, lodging, educational opportunities, and friendship provided through Diversity, under the leadership of Dan and Alina Fisher. For aiding the castaways and exposing many abuses within the fundamentalist culture, the FLDS and its controlling hierarchy hated Dan Fisher with a special passion. Dan refused to reciprocate the animosity despite an FLDS campaign of smears against him. The board of directors of the Diversity Foundation was not as forgiving. They decided that something stronger was needed from a legal standpoint to protect the children, and they hired Baltimore attorney Joanne Souter. My job for her was case preparation and process serving. The intense secrecy of the FLDS would make proving the case extremely difficult, but not impossible. There were scores of victims and eyewitnesses. I knew the evidence was out there, and I intended to find it. Joanne warned me the investigation would be a wide-ranging one that would require meticulous work, and also that she hated surprises. Like all of the attorneys with whom I work, she demanded that an investigator provide all the facts, good or bad. It is always a relief for me to hear that. It saves me from having to turn down the case. No matter what is found, it is always imperative to keep an open mind to all possibilities. In the words of Sherlock Holmes, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. However, professional objectivity did not mean that I was not personally shocked and appalled by things that would come to light in the course of my investigation, such as Warren raping children, child abandonment and neglect, and the ordeals of underage brides and families being ruined. I was not devoid of an opinion, very much to the contrary, but I draw a firm line between personal views and professional responsibility. Since Joanne was operating out of Baltimore, she needed an on-site attorney who could act as local counsel. She brought aboard prominent Salt Lake City lawyer Patrick A. Shea. He was a graduate of Stanford University, a Rhodes Scholar, held a law degree from Harvard, and was politically connected. Shea had run unsuccessfully for both governor and senator in Utah, and had served as head of the Bureau of Land Management under President Bill Clinton. Since returning to Utah from Washington, he had taught at colleges and universities and had written extensively on legal matters. Shea had his own private investigator, a local in Salt Lake City, and we got together to make sure that I had everything that he did. I found the guy to be a TV-style PI, who regaled me with tales of rich and famous clients and pointed out his $10,000 camera over here and his $10,000 computer over there. Everything in his office apparently cost $10,000. I didn't care. What did he actually have on the case? He handed over a three-ring binder enclosed around an inch of paper. Most of the material was straight off the internet, available to anybody who knew how to type. The PI was excited. "This is going to be a big case. John Krakauer is on it." "Who?" Never having paid much attention to famous people or bestseller lists, I wasn't even sure who Krakauer was. This was a time for hard, sweaty digging, and I had too much legwork to do to be getting involved with celebrities. He gave me a disbelieving look. "He's just one of the top five authors in the country. John is going to pick me up in a private jet, and we're going to go find Warren." The man apparently was not really familiar with Krakauer. As I would later learn, jets and celebrities weren't Krakauer's thing any more than they were mine. John Krakauer had been returning from a climbing trip in 1999 when he stopped for gas near Short Creek and noticed the settlement on the other side of the highway, a hazy hodgepodge of half-built houses and trailers in the distance. It seemed like something out of a Steinbeck novel. Curious, Krakauer decided to take a closer look. Crossing over the highway and going into town, he quickly began to realize that he had wandered into a different kind of place. Women working in their vegetable gardens were covered from their necks to their ankles in pioneer-style dresses that reminded him of Muslim burqas. All of the men wore long sleeves and their collars buttoned tight, and both men and women wore the same cheap sneakers. Then out of nowhere, a large 4x4 pickup with darkly tinted windows loomed into his rearview mirror and began aggressively tailing him. Krakauer is an athletic outdoorsman who loves to explore new places and is not easily spooked. He had climbed Mount Everest and had managed, barely, to make it off the mountain with his life. However, any uninvited stranger is likely to be unnerved by a Short Creek welcome. Krakauer couldn't shake the vigilantes following him, and they became increasingly aggressive. The globe-trotting author had never experienced anything like it. At least not in this country, and he later described the first confrontation with the FLDS as having scared the shit out of me. He left town in a hurry. Since there is nobody to call for help in Short Creek, Krakauer drove on until he found a national park ranger and reported what had happened. The ranger shrugged it off. "You were in Short Creek, the largest polygamous community in the country. That's the way it's been out there forever," he explained. Krakauer thought a lot about the desert town as he finished the long drive to his home in Colorado. Then he did some research into the FLDS church and realized he had stumbled onto some prime material for his next book. Krakauer spent the next 4 years investigating and writing Under the Banner of Heaven, the story of a couple of fundamentalist religious zealots who had stabbed a woman and her baby to death, believing that God had commanded them to commit the murders. The best-selling book would portray Short Creek as it really was, a place without joy that is run by a Taliban-style theocracy. It might never have been written if the xenophobic people of Short Creek had not run them out of town.
Chapter 12. Blood Atonement. The longed-for end of the millennium day of doom finally arrived, and once again, nothing happened. Word came again from the saddened prophet in Salt Lake City, relayed through his son, that the people were still too sinful to be worthy of entering God's sight. Again, they accepted the explanation. No matter what went wrong, the membership was at fault, and the poor, stricken prophet would no doubt have to suffer even harsher consequences to atone for their sinfulness.
The end of the world date was recast once more, this time for 2002, when Gentiles from all over the world would descend on Utah for the Winter Olympics based in Salt Lake City. Meanwhile, the world lived on, and so did the stricken Uncle Rulon with his scheming son at his side. Rulon had been something of a diplomat who had often ventured forth from Salt Lake City to visit the flock in Short Creek and in Canada. Some trips would be made aboard a chartered jet, others in luxury cars or a large mobile home. And after his mix of strokes, he traveled in a long white Lincoln Town Car towing a portable toilet on a trailer. The autocratic Warren lacked such diplomatic skills, but he was a shrewd politician who could count noses. Only a few hundred FLDS members still remained in Salt Lake, while thousands resided in Short Creek. If Warren was to consolidate his power and fight off future challengers, he needed to be nearer the heartbeat of the religion. A move to Short Creek would be required. Luckily, the Lord had given everyone an additional 2 years to prepare for Armageddon, which was plenty of time for him to engineer an exodus. All FLDS members in Salt Lake City were told to sell their homes and businesses, even if it meant taking substantial financial losses, to go into debt, to max out their credit cards because they would never have to repay them anyway, and herd together down in Short Creek. Alta Academy was closed, shuttered, and sold. One of my sources, Deborah Dockstader, who eventually bolted from the religion, recalled for me how her family had been ruined by that decision. Her husband and his three wives had docilely obeyed the order, gathered their children, sold everything, run up debt, and moved from their nice house in Salt Lake to a mouse-infested single-wide mobile home in Short Creek, where they lived crammed together and destitute. Such was not the case for the Jeffs. Rulon and Warren moved into a spacious new walled compound that was built for them covering an entire city block in Hilldale, on the Utah side of the creek. The overall effect of the FLDS abandonment of Salt Lake City was to slide the members even farther away from the rest of civilization and build a wall of empty miles between themselves and the rest of America. Warren settled in and got back to solidifying his position. He was the first counselor, but he quietly chafed at the popularity enjoyed by the second counselor, the amiable Fred Jessup, the bishop of Short Creek. Uncle Fred had accumulated a lot of influence during his long lifetime, and he was a calm listening post in sharp contrast to the mercurial Warren, who had to consider Fred a potential rival as a successor to Uncle Rulon. A formal photograph of the three men from that time shows Rulon seated in the middle, with Uncle Fred to his left, while at the prophet's right hand sat Warren, the unquestioned arbiter of all affairs. Fred would prove to be no match for the vigorous, much younger Warren. A more serious challenger in Warren's mind was Winston Blackmore, the bishop of the 1,000-person FLDS enclave up in bountiful British Columbia, just over the U.S.-Canadian border and about 900 miles north of Short Creek. Blackmore had an almost rock star status within the religion, in which he was known as Uncle Wink. With a large family of his own, an unshakable faith, an outgoing personality, and a loyal following, he tried to live as an example of what he believed the FLDS was really all about. In sharp contrast to the Jeffs, Bishop Blackmore eschewed any extravagant lifestyle. Winston had been a close friend of Uncle Rulon for many years, and he answered only to the prophet. He was not about to give in to Warren's strong-arm tactics. The two men were on a collision course that would play out across many months, and the issue was one of life or death for a teenage girl. Most FLDS members and leaders are superstitious to the point of mysticism in their beliefs. Legends and old wives' tales are passed down among families as truths. Poultices are preferred to doctors, and the members even have a formal ritual for the blessing of the brakes of their pickup trucks. Taking an archaic notion out of history and molding it to suit their skewed agenda is common practice. One of the most brutal elements handed down over the generations, blood atonement, The doctrine that states a sinner must pay for his or her offense by shedding his or her own blood has been around for many years. I believe it is still practiced today within the FLDS. More than two decades earlier, in a legal action to strip Short Creek Marshal Sam Barlow of his badge, polygamist Harold Blackmore had sworn in an affidavit, "While being instructed in our duties and responsibilities, we were taught the divine law of retribution, commonly called blood atonement. I listened to Guy H. Musser teach this doctrine with a quivering and doomful voice to a large assembly of men as follows. You, brethren, you have got to learn to give strict obedience to every request made of you by this priesthood council. You have to prepare yourselves to the point where you will shed the blood of any one of your brethren if we tell you to, for the sake of his salvation, as atonement for his sins and to prove your faithfulness." I have listened to Rulon T. Jeffs preach along the same line with passionate fervor. You brethren, you have got to learn to submit and take direction. You have got to learn to obey anything we tell you to do without the slightest mental reservation, right or wrong. Without exception, every single former FLDS person I have interviewed concerning the practice has expressed the unequivocal belief that it is considered a true principle of the religion. By the same token, I have yet to talk to anyone who has actually witnessed such a bloodletting. But I believe, just as the Utah Attorney General's office did, that Warren Jeffs wanted, but failed, to have a father bring his daughter home and face death in a religious ritual in the year 2000. That they totally believed in the bizarre ritual is beyond doubt. A widow of Rulon Jeffs described for me a time that she and one of her sister wives came across a passage they did not understand while studying a book that Rulon had written, Purity in the New and Everlasting Covenant of Marriage. It was mandatory reading for all wives, and in it, Rulon claimed that Brigham Young had announced in a sermon more than a century earlier that some sins were so heinous that even the atonement of the Savior was insufficient to pardon the transgressor and gain salvation. The only possible remedy that might bring redemption would be for the offender to shed his or her own blood. Rulon wrote that blood atonement was an act of love and duty. He left no doubt that he was not talking about pricking a finger, but about murder. I could refer you to plenty of instances where men have been righteously slain in order to atone for their sins. I have seen scores and hundreds of people for whom there would have been a chance for salvation if their lives had been taken and their blood spilled on the ground as a smoking incense to the Almighty, but who are now angels to the devil until our elder brother Jesus Christ raises them up, conquers death, hell, and the grave. I have known a great many men who have left this church for whom there is no chance whatever for exaltation, but if their blood had been spilled, it would have been better for them. This is loving your neighbor as yourselves. If he needs help, help him. And if he wants salvation and it is necessary to spill his blood on the earth in order that he may be saved, spill it. This was heady material for the two wives. Fortunately, while they sat puzzling over the book on the stairs inside Rulon's home, Warren came walking past and they asked if he knew anything about it. Yes, he replied. It was a true and correct principle. He not only endorsed it, he described his vision of the ritual for them in frightening detail. The sinner had to be bound to an altar of stone, preferably in a sacred place such as a temple. A rope of a specific size would be blessed by a ritualistic prayer and then tied to certain areas of the body in the manner with which Abraham lashed down his son Isaac when God had commanded Abraham to slay the boy as an offering. As he warmed to the impromptu lecture, Warren told the women that everything was done in accordance with holy ordinances, and each step of the process had a special meaning. For instance, special ropes and knots were required, and the event should be done in a basement to signify the subject rising from the terrestrial kingdom and overcoming hell. When the subject was secure, A mask was placed over the face of the condemned person, and a special knife was used to cut the throat of the victim in a proscribed manner. After that, some of the blood was saved to be drunk by priesthood members in attendance, to seal their oaths to keep the sacred procedure a secret, even if it meant their own lives. The rest of the blood was to be burned, so that the smoke could rise to the heavens as a burnt offering and hopefully be accepted there by God. He ended the hair-raising lesson by saying it had to be kept a strict secret, because the outside world would not understand and would try to stop the practice if it became known. I got to know Winston Blackmore during the Lost Boys investigation, and he became one of my most knowledgeable guides into figuring out what made Warren Jeffs tick. He would personally tell me the story of a troubled girl named Vanessa Robach, a daughter of Uncle Rulon's old dining and drinking buddy, Ron Robach. She had been given, without her consent, to be the third wife of a man in Short Creek. "I about died," she had confided to Blackmore. "I was only 16, and I didn't want to marry that guy, but I was told that if I did not do it, there would be nothing more for me, ever. What could I do? When my mouth said, 'I do,' my heart was screaming, 'No, no, no.'" She ran away to stay with a sister who had already been expelled from the FLDS, then had second thoughts and returned to her father's home. Soon, she began to sneak away again to meet a boyfriend about her own age. He would turn off the lights of his truck and coast up to the house, where Vanessa would jump in, and they would go share a pizza. The couple was followed one night, caught, and hauled before First Counselor Warren Jeffs. He decided that since Vanessa was a married woman, even though she had not wanted to wed, she must bear total blame. It was decided to let her influential father, Ron Robach, take her up to Canada for a cooling-off period. The extraordinarily lenient decision was a good example of the benefits that can accrue to a loyalist within the inner circle. Warren telephoned Winston Blackmore to tell him the teenager would be coming for a temporary visit, adding that she was on antidepressants and had to be considered suicidal. Blackmore agreed to take her in, and soon Vanessa responded to the distancing of herself from the tumultuous situation in Short Creek. She was persuasive enough in her apology that Uncle Rulon extended a further favor to his friend Ron and gave Winston Blackmore permission to forgive the girl's sins through rebaptism, which Winston did. Vanessa, now with a clean slate, then upset everything by announcing that she wanted to get married again, but to her boyfriend, someone of her own choosing. Warren exploded in rage during a heated telephone call to Blackmore. "There it is," Warren said. "I told Father if you let this girl get rebaptized, then the next thing she will want to do is get remarried, and there it is." He could not overturn Rulon's decision to forgive her, but he had a different idea. "Her baptism did not work," Warren ordered. "She shall not be remarried. There is nothing left for her to do but to come back and have her blood shed for the remission of her sins. You are instructed to tell her to gather up her things and to go away. You and Ron, Vanessa's father, are instructed to pray night and day for the Lord to destroy her from the face of the earth." Warren was condemning the girl to death. No trial, no mercy, no defense, and all while Uncle Rulon was in his bed and asleep. Winston recalled for me in a halting voice. The horrified Blackmore would have no part of it. Robach showed up in Canada under a strict order from Warren to retrieve his daughter. "Ron Robach was the meanest man I've ever met," Blackmore told me. He said he was the one who had brought Vanessa into this world, and it was his priesthood duty to take her out of this world. He was ordered to love his daughter enough to carry out the edict in order for her to have a chance at salvation. Blackmore refused to hand the child over for retribution. He kept her, secreted away in a distant house, and her father returned empty-handed to Short Creek. The confrontation escalated as time passed, and Warren sent Robach back to Canada two more times, including a trip on which he was backed up by Warren's brother, Leroy Jeffs. Blackmore not only refused their demands, but notified the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which contacted the FBI and the Utah Attorney General's office. The word went out. If Warren did not stop this mad crusade against the child, the law would intervene. Warren backed off, but he never forgot. Vanessa eventually married the boy she originally wanted, and against all logic, they settled in Short Creek. I have seen that same decision made repeatedly by outcasts, because it is so difficult for residents to give up the only way of life they have ever known. Blackmore observed that so much official attention had been focused on her situation that Vanessa probably was the safest woman in town. Warren Jeffs would later insist that his words had been misunderstood. However, I am convinced that without the intervention of Winston Blackmore, Vanessa would have been sacrificed in a blood atonement ritual. Ron Robach's failure to deliver his daughter for punishment earned him a place on Warren's blacklist. As far as Warren was concerned, his father's old buddy was expendable. Punishment would be years in coming, but when it came, Warren would destroy Robach. Chapter 13. Death in the Family. The mind of Rulon Jeffs wandered, spinning off in the middle of conversations onto subjects as arcane as how his own father used to call him Rudy Pergucius. Warren's quicksilver brain took up the slack. As the effects of the strokes and dementia continued to marginalize Rulon, Warren was the puppet master, able to get his father to do anything. Warren would occasionally take his feeble father to the meeting house to preside over a church service. A microphone would be rigged around the neck of the seated old man. Then Warren would whine out a long sermon and graciously turn to Rulon and say, "Let's hear what Father is thinking. We would like to turn the time over to the prophet to hear the word of God." Silence would smother the crowd for long minutes while Rulon, mouth agape, would struggle to put together some words, eventually blurting out some accusations such as, "The judgments of God are upon you. Do you understand?" To which the congregation would respond with a unanimous, "Yes." The father definitely still had usefulness in Warren's plans. In one of his boldest moves, Warren persuaded Rulon to give him the management of the United Effort Plan Trust. Warren personally supervised the revision of the trust documents, then steadied the feeble old man's hand as he signed away his authority. That meant all of the UEP holdings, an avalanche of assets and property in the United States and Canada, now shifted to Warren's direct control. A required board of trustees was made up of hand-picked loyalists, but he made all of the decisions and held veto power. Millions of dollars were generated annually, and it all would be administered by Warren. All comments about business were carefully phrased by Warren to get Rulon to make the right choices. In one of his more lucid moments, Rulon apparently realized he no longer ran the empire. He broke down at dinner, pounded his fist on the table and shouted, "I won my job back." Warren swiftly soothed him. It was too late for Rulon. Warren had control, and he never gave up anything. Perhaps to calm murmurs from dissidents that he wanted to take over everything officially, Warren spread a secret. Rulon was going to live for hundreds of years to come. Even Rulon had not known about this until the thought came tumbling out of Warren's rambling imagination. In an interview with me, one FLDS member described paying a visit to the ailing old man one day. The ever-present Warren asked if the visitor would like to hear of a vision that Rulon had experienced. "Sure," said the visitor. And Warren pulled out a little notepad that he scribbled in. "At 2:30 one morning," said Warren, "his father awakened him to describe a vision in which the prophet Rulon had seen a beautiful large valley filled with young women and children, and he had understood it to be his own future. The vision placed the valley more than 300 years in the future, and Rulon was to reach it without ever tasting death. It was such a startling idea that Uncle Rulon whispered,
"Did I say that? I don't remember a thing of it."
The visitor then watched in astonishment as other church officials came and went, and Warren related the same fable of longevity to each in turn. His father continued to say he didn't remember anything of the sort. Very soon, that was all that Warren wanted to talk about, the visitor confided. We heard it in church, we heard it in private, and there soon became a great fervor. The big lie, relentlessly pounded home by Warren, became accepted as truth. That was when Warren began thrusting young girls upon Rulon, allegedly to make sure that the prophet would have the ladies needed to procreate with him through the coming centuries. In reality, Warren had a much different plan in mind, one that only he knew. Until the time was ripe to unveil it, marrying the girls to Rulon would remove them from the market of brides available for other men. While his mind might be slipping, the stroke-crippled Rulon still had a sexual appetite, or at least imagined that he did, at 92 years of age. Sometimes a new wife would be shocked to get a wet French kiss from the old man after the evening meal. When one girl proved reluctant to comply with the elderly Rulon's wish for some unconventional sex, Warren set her straight in a hurry. God's command was to give yourself to your husband, mind, body, and soul. In other words, do whatever Rulon wanted. To do otherwise would jeopardize her status as a mother in Zion. Since there is no such thing as sex education within the FLDS culture, when a young girl was placed with a depraved older man, it would usually be a confusing and crushing experience. She often had little or no idea about sex. Warren, acting as his father's self-appointed pimp, kept track of what was happening, and he would be furious if the concubines did not keep sweet and comply with the arranged sexual liaisons. On a visit down south from Canada, Winston Blackmore was shocked at the fresh new crop of young girls ranging in age from 21 down to 15 entering the Jeffs family. The bishop asked what was going on. Rulon replied,
"I don't know. Ask Warren. Why am I being married to all these young girls?"
Uncle Rulon married some of them while he was abed, delirious, and unaware of what was happening. Marriage licenses, of course, were not required. Simply a sealing ritual by someone in the church hierarchy who was authorized by the prophet to conduct the ceremony was sufficient. The ceremony had absolutely no legal standing, especially since it was usually performed in conjunction with the crimes of child abuse and/or polygamy. Warren continued placing new spouses with his father up until only 6 months before the decrepit prophet's mortal ministry came to an end. It finally took a direct, desperate plea from Rulon himself.
"No more wives!"
to make Warren stop. On the surface, the purpose of the onslaught of marriages was to benefit Rulon. Underlying that fact was Warren maneuvering toward a completely different and sordid purpose. He intended to marry some of his stepmothers into his own growing harem when the old man passed away. Another myth that has come down in FLDS lore is that the final destruction of the earth will be so complete that not a yellow dog will be left to wag its tail. In the summer of 2001, that nightmare would come true in Short Creek. With Uncle Rulon physically fading, Warren needed to test his own support. Was it real? Had his incessant trainings and sermons programmed the believers strongly enough to ensure that they would follow him automatically? Could he count on their blind obedience and loyalty when he took the ultimate leadership role? A horrible tragedy provided the opening for him to test them. Best of all, the target of this grim scheme was one of the rare Gentile converts in their midst, who I will refer to as Mike. So not too many people in the Crick really cared much about what happened to him or his family, No matter how devout their beliefs, converts are never really accepted as anything more than second-class citizens. In June 2001, a chained-up guard dog that was used for breeding attacked, mauled, and killed the family's baby boy. Soon afterward, at the meeting house, Uncle Fred Jessup told the congregants that Prophet Rulon had received a heavenly revelation that pets had no place in the kingdom of God, not among the pure and clean people of the priesthood. Henceforth, no dogs would be allowed. Everyone understood that this was really Warren talking. Warren didn't like dogs. Uncle Fred was passionate from the pulpit that day. Not giving up your pet would be an act of disobedience, proving that you lacked faith. Your standing in the priesthood would be in question, which could lead to expulsion from the church and community. Citizens of Short Creek would be given some time to rid themselves of their pets voluntarily. But after that, assigned crews of churchmen led by that peculiar pair of enforcers, Willie and D. Jessup, would be called on to finish the job. Local law would not be involved in the massacre. Although the cops were thoroughly in service to the FLDS, this nasty piece of work fell to the church's hooligans without badges. To be called to service in such a position was a rare opportunity for these men to distinguish themselves from the rank-and-file membership. They could move about the community and force compliance from the disobedient, which meant that now they were somebody. When the grace period expired for people to have disposed of their pets, the gang came in to round up the dogs that had not been given away. They started with the strays, but soon they were snatching pets from the arms of their owners. D. Jessup went through the streets like a destroying angel, fulfilling his macabre mission. Willie would often be parked in a conspicuous spot nearby to intervene if there was any backlash from a broken-hearted family member. The captured dogs were driven in trucks out of town to the far side of a sylvan setting known as Berry Knoll, where dusk almost always brings a double sunset as the sun slides down two mountains that nearly touch at Canaan Gap. Not only is light magnified out there, but so is the sound. Residents of the Crick would hear the squeal of a pickup truck's tires on the pavement in town. Then not long afterward would come the wail of a dog, as if through a megaphone, followed by a gunshot out by Berry Knoll. Finally, the guns were deemed too noisy for the job, and the killers came up with the idea of clamping jumper cables from the powerful batteries of big pickup trucks onto the animals to electrocute them. Instead of gunshots, the howls of the tortured dogs rent the night air. There are no more dogs or cats to be found in Short Creek or other Jeffs Run FLDS strongholds to this day. For Warren Jeffs, it was a diabolical test of loyalty. If he could get people to surrender their pets to the executioner, he could continue pushing the envelope and demand even greater sacrifices. The ready-made scapegoat, Mike, was left to shoulder any emotional blame. After all, it was his dog and his child that had precipitated the drastic measures. Warren threw him out of the church, and nobody cared. Rulon Jeffs was aware throughout 2002 that he was barely clinging to life. One day, as he shuffled along on his walk with a group of wives and children assisting him, the prophet told them he was tired of living, and the helpers would not be burdened with this escort duty much longer. He struck a fist on his chest and called out,
"I am so sick of this decrepit body. When do I get to go?"
The answer was, not yet. He still had some usefulness for his heir apparent. The reign of Winston Blackmore as the prophet's right-hand man in Canada ended abruptly with a single phone call from the ailing Rulon in the summer of 2002. Blackmore was in his truck with a visitor from Short Creek, Ezra Draper, who heard every word over the speakerphone, and Winston himself later confirmed the incident for me. Winston was well aware that his old friend Rulon was no longer mentally stable, but although the old man stumbled as he groped for words, he laid down the law. Blackmore was dismissed as the Bishop of Bountiful. He was instructed to surrender his wives, was removed as a UEP trustee, and was ordered to turn all of his business assets over to the UEP. Draper said that after each pronouncement, there would be a pause in the conversation, and they could hear the voice of Warren Jeffs in the background, coaching his father on what to say next. The old man would repeat those words verbatim. "Rulon Jeffs didn't even know who he was talking to," Draper recalled. "Warren told him what to say, sentence by sentence." When Ezra Draper returned home to Short Creek, he feigned innocence and asked Warren how the dismissal of the Canadian bishop had gone. Warren beamed with pride.
"Ezra, Father handled that situation all by himself."
The blood atonement attempt involving Vanessa Robach was a side issue by then, but Winston's defiance had been remembered by Warren. His revenge for that embarrassment was to engineer the removal of Blackmore as a potential rival for leadership of the FLDS. Warren later dispatched his God Squad enforcer, Willie Jessup, up to Canada to make sure that Winston understood that he no longer held priesthood. Blackmore, though, was unafraid of the bully and refused to recognize Warren's claims of authority. There was fallout any time someone crossed Warren Jeffs, who kept track of every perceived trespass in his little notebook. He eventually expelled both Ezra Draper and his brother David, and told them there was no hope of their getting back in. Ezra managed to leave with most of his family intact, but David was devastated at losing his family and everything he had. Ezra made a luncheon appointment to talk with his distraught brother, but David did not show up. His body was found in the wreckage of his truck at the bottom of Hurricane Mesa, about 20 miles from Short Creek, along with a suicide note. As Warren's appetite for power grew, so did the body count of devastated victims, both literally and figuratively. That the end was near for Rulon was probably obvious to his scheming son. In fact, it couldn't have been going better if he had actually personally planned it that way. Several years would pass before I was able to piece together the dramatic final sequence of events through personal interviews with people who were there, recordings of the services, and the descriptions detailed in Warren's priesthood record. It was a macabre glimpse into the final days of a religious monarch and the rise of his ambitious successor. Rulon Timpson Jeffs finally died on September 8, 2002. He was rushed to the hospital in septic shock from an obstructed bowel and was in such dire condition that doctors estimated he had only a 5% chance of survival if they performed surgery, and no chance at all without it.
"It does not matter what they say. The Lord is in charge," Warren told his brother Isaac. The old man's blood pressure was very low, but suddenly it rose enough for the doctors to operate. A miracle. "We knew he was going to walk out of there, no question," said Isaac.
Rulon was grimacing on a respirator as the medical staff wheeled him to the operating theater aboard a gurney. When he was returned to the intensive care unit, his heart began to stutter. Family and friends knelt in prayer circles as CPR, then electric shock treatment, were performed. Warren was on his knees on the floor at his dying father's bedside.
"I could not think of anything else but his renewal in this life, but as I witnessed his final breath and his heart stop, I wanted to cry unto the Lord to intervene now, but the good spirit whispered, 'Peace, this is the Lord's will.'"
Still, the actual death seemed to surprise almost everyone, as they waited patiently for Rulon to be renewed into his former youthful self. It had become a matter of faith that Rulon, as the living prophet, would be the one who would finally hand the keys of the kingdom over to the returned Savior, Jesus Christ. In reality, all he did was die, and the keys were snatched away by his conniving son. The legion of shaken wives had believed the promises made to them of eternal life, that Rulon would be changed in the twinkling of an eye back into his vibrant prime. God had raised the dead in the scriptures. Surely the prophet deserved the same blessing. There was no doubt in my mind that he would just come back. One of the many widows told me God would touch him, and he would be made young in every sense of the word. He would be able to walk around with us and know our names and have time for us and things like that. When Roulon was buried 4 days later, their faith still had not wavered. At the funeral, it was just so freaky and so hard, a wife remembered. When they shut the casket for the last time, it was like, "No, you can't do that. He's going to bang on it and say, 'What the hell are you guys doing? We truly expected that.'" With angelic sweetness, a choir of wives sang an original 5-minute composition entitled, "Our Prophet is Caught Up," which included the words, "He shall come forth again to earth and lead his people on." Warren stood tall beside the grave, and some of the women said he was aglow with heavenly brightness. His long wait for power was over. Chapter 14. Stepmothers and Wives. Warren Jeffs wasted no time grieving for his father. He had a religion to run. It was also time to start cashing in on his aspirations, and his first item was taking the women he wanted from his father's harem. He stepped before a special leadership meeting 2 days after Roulon's death and coldly announced, "I'm here to tell you, men, hands off my father's wives." He explained, "Now I understand what father was doing, building up his family so I could carry on." He had first choice, and the rest would be reassigned to loyal men whom he selected, and who would then be stuck with the financial responsibility of caring for the less desirable wives and children. By announcing his intention to wed many of his own stepmothers, he broke a taboo, which shook the entire FLDS. Many contended that it was a violation of the biblical law of Moses, which stated that a man shall not marry his father's wives. Those accusations led Warren to formulate rambling rationalizations and revelations from God, which he would dispense to the flock as needed, like scattering feed before chickens. "People are searching the history and they can't quite match up the present situation with anything else," he said, according to a section of his record. If people did not understand his logic, it obviously was their fault because their hearts were dark. Opponents were warned that they were treading down the path to apostasy by criticizing his work toward the celestialization of this earth. What he was really saying, in words cloaked in piety, was that opposing opinions would be dealt with swiftly and severely. Many of Roulon's wives reeled at what they perceived to be incest, so Warren sweet-talked and perplexed them with revelations from beyond the grave. "Every one of you ladies, my mothers, are worth more than worlds to father. Through you, he will bring forth sons and daughters that will become gods here and in the spirit world, and those gods will create worlds upon worlds." It was confusing. Warren had a way of speaking in tangled sentences that meant nothing, but slowly they understood that he intended to bed and have children by them because that was father's and God's will. He was speaking in the present tense as if Roulon were standing in the room. Trained throughout their entire lives to be docile in the face of a man's authority, most eventually agreed. One absolutely refused. Lorraine had been married to Roulon for 7 years and was an anomaly among FLDS women. She had somehow managed to grow up with a mind of her own, and she was willing to challenge Warren's advances toward her and her sister wives. She would not be bullied. Warren wanted this beautiful woman badly, but she was equally adamant about having nothing to do with him. Finally, in a fit of frustration and desperation, he glared at her with maniacal fierceness, wagged his bony index finger in her face, and promised, "I'm going to break you, young lady." At that point, Lorraine knew her life would become a living hell if she did nothing to protect herself. That very evening, she decided to leave the FLDS rather than endure the punishment certain to come her way for refusing to marry the demented son of her late husband. Lorraine literally went over the wall of the Jeffs compound and escaped. Another special wife was Mary Fisher, the nurse and sister of Dan Fisher, who had constantly tended Rulon prior to his death. She knew everything about both Rulon and Warren, and Warren was concerned that Mary would turn against him, like her brothers Dan and Shem. He could not risk losing Mother Mary to the world and having her reveal her secrets to the authorities, so he persuaded her to marry him. Afterward, he kept her in hiding, virtually as a voluntary prisoner. She, like many other women, had become a victim of circumstance, and she had nowhere else to go. She would only emerge occasionally when her nursing skills were needed within the closed society, and then she would be ferreted off to a new hiding place to avoid detection. Polygamy is the heart of FLDS doctrine, and Warren Jeffs was going to see to it that he had more wives than anyone else, even if it meant marrying his mothers. I have personally counted more than 80 wives, and others pegged the number at better than 90. Within a few years of seizing power, he would brag in a sermon before a huge gathering of FLDS members that Heavenly Father had revealed to him that he would have 100 wives. After throwing a fence around his stepmothers, Warren turned his attention to consolidating his leadership. He would later write, "All of the people are asking, who did Uncle Rulon appoint?" Warren acknowledged that within the governing body of the church, there was nothing to show that he was the legitimate heir. The FLDS has never had an organized rite of succession, no rule book, and no protocol to fall back on. And so, historically, an internal fight would usually ensue when the top position came open. Warren knew that he had to be smarter, faster, more ruthless, and quicker on his feet than any rival. His closest potential rival was the faithful Fred Jessup, the bishop of Short Creek. Uncle Fred had been around a very long time and had earned a loyal base of followers. Dissident Flora Jessup, the daughter of one of his half-brothers, described Uncle Fred in her book, Church of Lies, as a mover and shaker in the FLDS and rich to boot. During the reign of Rulon Jeffs, Uncle Fred handled affairs concerning the town, including the collection of church tithes, 10% of everyone's income. The tall, quiet man had remained as the faithful second counselor without protest when Warren had usurped the position of first counselor back in 1997. Uncle Fred, however, was tragically flawed by something that would never permit him to be the official leader of a cultish religion that expects men to be the fertile producers of squadrons of youngsters. He was sterile, physically unable to have kids of his own. Fred built his own large family of reassigned wives and children, widows, and orphans. The package was a stew with many ingredients. And the residents of Short Creek loved him for being such a benevolent benefactor. Warren had to tread lightly in dealing with Uncle Fred. According to the priesthood record, the two men had a private meeting in which Warren swore to follow Fred if the Lord wants you to lead. Fred answered that God had given him no such instruction, but that he had somehow seen a vision of Uncle Lewis. That would be Lewis Barlow, the patriarch of a large and influential family in the Crick. This vision was unsettling news for Warren, who wanted to hear Uncle Fred declare undying support for him. Fred, in his 90s, probably just wanted to spend his last years in peace, not in a religious gang war. Under pressure, and knowing that he was no match for the conniving favorite son of the dead prophet, Fred wavered and promised to submit to whoever the Lord chose. Given my experience, I can imagine that the old pioneer was wise enough to realize that going up against Warren's ruthless ambitions would end up in a public bloodletting in which he would likely lose everything at a very vulnerable time in his life. Warren silently put old Lewis Barlow in his private list of enemies to be dealt with at some future time. Just putting Uncle Fred in his place was not going to be enough to persuade everyone to follow along. Warren needed witnesses if he was to cement his power play. Although he did not trust her, Warren brought Mother Mary, Rulon's former wife and nurse who knew all of the secrets, to the pulpit during a meeting. She had been at the dying prophet's bedside night and day and had witnessed all the details of Rulon's last moments in mortality. Now totally dependent upon Warren for her existence, Mary dutifully testified that the prophet had indeed expressed a fervent wish that Warren follow him as the next leader. Women, however, have no standing in the FLDS, which weakened her testimony substantially, and the old-timers were grumbling that there was no priesthood authority to testify of Rulon's last wishes. Warren needed the backing of a priesthood man. His brother Isaac assumed that task, and in the future, he would be richly rewarded for his choice. Isaac stepped forward and announced that all the way back in August of 2001, he had heard Rulon speak about Warren during a meeting, saying, "The finger of the Lord is pointing to this man." Isaac further testified that as they drove home on the eventful day, he had heard Rulon tell Warren several times,
"I want you to accept the presidency of this church to take my place."
Isaac did not stop there. He emphasized that Rulon had repeated his decision about 30 times on that one day. Even when his wives and Isaac helped the prophet to the bathroom, the old man had closed his eyes, bowed his head, then looked at the wall and declared,
"Warren is going to be the next leader of this people."
Back in his bed, he said it again and again. During the crucial weeks after the death of Rulon, Warren would repeatedly cite Isaac's testimony to justify his claim of FLDS leadership. He was careful not to mention that his brother's remarks as a witness had not surfaced until after the old man was dead. No one seemed to recall that during the time Rulon allegedly made the important comments, Warren had stated that Rulon had the mind of a child. It had been obvious to those close to him that Rulon often hadn't even known what day it was, so perhaps he would have found it difficult to express opinions on intricate church matters. Rulon never wrote down his wishes, designating a legal successor to follow him as president of the FLDS Church. Because there were no rules for succession within the FLDS, the combination of questionable personal testimonies from Isaac and Mary, plus the nod of the cowed Uncle Fred, had to be good enough, and Warren named himself the new prophet, seer, and revelator. It wasn't in writing, but that too was about to be remedied. The only real problem left was the uneasy situation in Canada, where the decision to fire Winston Blackmore as bishop had caused a deep split. Some strain had always existed between the FLDS groups in Canada and the United States. Despite mutual claims of friendship, those living in the Crick believed the Canadians were much too lax in discipline. The Canadians felt the Americans were much too rigid. As long as the friendship existed between the late Uncle Rulon and Winston Blackmore, differences could usually be worked out. Not so with Warren at the helm. As a private investigator, I am always on the lookout for possible sources of information. So I contacted Blackmore by telephone in 2004 and introduced myself, and, to my surprise, he agreed to speak with me. I found him to be an affable man who could communicate easily with people in the outside world while still maintaining his strong, unconventional beliefs in polygamy. A key difference between Winston and the FLDS brand of polygamy was that he no longer condoned the practice of underage marriage. Although admitting to having taken at least two underage brides while still a member of the FLDS Church, he said that he had come to the realization that the practice was wrong and illegal, and he would never promote, condone, or participate in the practice again. In the months to come, Blackmore and I would have numerous intense discussions about polygamy and the differences between his fundamentalist and my equally strong mainstream Mormon beliefs. Fortunately, I did not have to agree with his views, nor he with mine, in order to establish a rapport and talk openly about issues that might be beneficial to my investigation. My job was not to convert him. He was a source who willingly opened a window for me into the hierarchy of the FLDS. He became a knowledgeable guide into the intricacies of his fundamentalist religion, which he never abandoned, and of the dark side of the FLDS religion, which he had abandoned. He told me about his basic disagreement with Warren. "One of the most frequent questions asked is about a power struggle between me and Warren," Blackmore said. "Now, I don't know what that is, but I will tell you about my own struggle. I had to struggle when I was told that there was not enough time left to help anyone repent. I struggled when I saw men who had been restored and forgiven in the days of Uncle Roy and Uncle Rulon, and now have their families swept away from them and their homes given to another. I struggled when I saw men's wages given to the church and then see their boss go buy a new Lexus. I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't struggle trying to believe there could be anything Mormon about what was happening." Blackmore said that he had come to dread being summoned down to Short Creek by church leaders because he never knew in advance if the purpose was to sign some business document, have a meeting with Warren, simply to visit Rulon, or to marry another wife. "I'm telling you, it is not a good feeling thinking that you may be coming home with some young girl," Blackmore observed. "A lot of people think it's about having sex with a new girl, and maybe for some people it may be, but the reality of it is, there's nothing pleasurable about it." A new young bride meant disruption of the status quo of the household, more in-laws with whom to deal, and an added financial burden. Winston Blackmore had developed a more pragmatic view of polygamy and of life. My personal views of whether or not Winston was being forthright with me concerning his change of heart regarding child abuse were only relevant to me with respect to his credibility. If I were to have found out he was lying to me, which I have not, I would still have maintained a relationship with Winston because that is my job. When I make contact with a junkie that is willing to share with me his experiences and provide me with information that will be beneficial to my case, I do not refuse to speak with him if I find out that he is shooting heroin. Winston helped me to gain a more complete understanding of the dark side of the FLDS Church and its leaders, and for that, I remain grateful. After being dismissed by Rulon during the Warren Coach telephone call, Blackmore was replaced as the Bishop of Bountiful by a quiet and obscure mechanic named Jim Oler, a staunch Warren loyalist. About half of the membership stopped following Blackmore or listening to his sermons and followed Warren's substitute, Oler. The rest stuck by the defrocked Blackmore. Winston's wives ignored Jeff's warnings to either leave Blackmore or be doomed to hell and never see their families again. It was a typical FLDS schism, dissidents within dissidents. Blackmore remained in the Bountiful area as the minister of his own congregation and provided a safe haven for people who had run-ins with Warren. One of their few alternatives was to get to Canada and seek solace from Uncle Wink. Warren Jeffs would always remain angry with the continuing influence of Blackmore, regarding it as a poison. An uprising of bad feelings started in Canada, and it was filtering through the people, he would repeatedly state. Blackmore no longer presented a true threat as a political rival, but that did not mean he was not dangerous in other significant ways. In contrast with Warren's maniacal hatred of the law, Winston Blackmore chose to cooperate smoothly with a number of law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. Chapter 15. Predator. 15 months would pass between the time that Warren Jeffs took over the FLDS and the time I first set foot into his private world with my initial visit to Short Creek to meet Ross Chatwin. That interval seemed to close fast. Over the years I would spend investigating him and his church, I became